Boar's Head is bringing a slice of Japan to the deli. Introducing Boar's Head Ichiban Teriyaki-Style Chicken. Tender, slow-roasted chicken breast, coated in our signature teriyaki glaze, where ginger, garlic, and a hint of brown sugar meet for a flavor that's both sweet and savory. New Boar's Head Ichiban Teriyaki-Style Chicken. The bold flavor of Japan. Now at the deli. Only from Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast. I am, of course, Nick Peters, your host, and today we are going to be talking about Luke. And that does, of course, refer to the Gospel writer, who was also the writer of Acts. Or was he? Well, I'm sure my guest has something to say about that as well. And who is my guest today? My guest is Daryl Bach. Daryl Bach is Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, Texas. He serves as well as the Executive Director of Cultural Engagement for the Seminary's Center for Cultural Leadership. And his areas of interest and special study are hermeneutics, the use of the Old Testament in the New, Luke, Acts, historical Jesus, gospel studies, and integrating theology and culture. He's also served on the board of Chosen People Ministries for a decade and at Wheaton College. He got a B.A. at the University of Texas, a Th.M. at Dallas Theological Seminary, and a Ph.D. at the University of Aberdeen. He's had four stints of postdoctoral study at the University of Tübingen, second through fourth as an Alexander von Humboldt scholar. And he serves as an elder emeritus at Trinity Fellowship Church in Richardson, Texas, an editor-at-large of Christianity Today, and president of Evangelical Philosophical Society for 1 year. He's authored 30 books, including a New York Times bestseller on nonfiction and another release that's just come out, Truth Matters, which we could have him come back on the show to discuss sometime. That's being worked on, which is a response to many issues skeptics raise about Christianity. In his personal life, he's married to Sally and has two daughters, both married, and a son, two grandsons, and a granddaughter. Well, that's certainly very impressive, and somehow he's managed to fill in not just the time to be on my show, but the time to be on Augustine Eustachio's show talking about blasphemy. So if you're here listening to this after hearing that, welcome aboard, and please come back regularly and hear us. But for now, let me turn the reins over here and introduce my guest, Dr. Bach. Hello, Dr. Bach.
How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing fine. I'm guessing this has been an exhausting day for you. Have you ever had to do two interviews like this directly in a row?
Well, I've done multiple interviews back-to-back, but I don't think I've ever scheduled to do 3 hours before. It feels a little bit like a doctoral oral exam.
Okay, we'll try and be as light here as we can. And let's start with asking a question that I'm sure they probably don't ask you at a doctorate or exam. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to be doing what you're doing today.
Well, I grew up in a non-Christian home and came to the Lord in college, and in the midst of that process decided the Lord was calling me to go to seminary. So I did Old Testament studies at Dallas for my master's, and then went and did 3 years in Scotland for a Ph.D., working particularly in Luke, Acts, and the use of the Old Testament and the New for Christology. That was what my dissertation was about. And then immediately went back to Dallas to teach. So I'm finishing my 32nd year at Dallas. I've spent four sabbaticals in Tübingen, in Germany. The last three on a Humboldt scholarship, which is a scholarship that comes from the Federal Republic of Germany that that is an exchange, a scholarly exchange program. And have spent the bulk of my life writing about issues in the Gospels and Acts. That's really where my focus has been.
Well, since you mentioned Luke, Acts, that is the topic that we've asked you to discuss today. What is so important about Luke, Acts? Why should a Christian care about them?
Well, the major thing to say is, and most people don't realize this, is that Luke, as the writer of Luke, Acts, is responsible for more of the New Testament than any other writer. Most people think that's Paul because he has so many epistles. But if you add up all of that material, Luke beats Paul by about 2%. And between Paul and Luke, you've got about 60% of your New Testament. So obviously, he's one of the major writers contributing to the New Testament. He also has about 50% of his material is unique to his gospel, so that's important. We see the variety of Jesus' teaching, particularly his ethical teaching, as a result of his writing. We get a deeper insight into the variety of things Jesus talked about. So that's important. And then a third feature is, by writing the book of Acts, which gives us a selective view of the history of the early church, no one else has done that for us in the New Testament. So if we didn't have the book of Acts, we would actually know very little about the history of the first century church. So that's another major gift that Luke has given us in his writing.
In fact, Luke is the only source we have for some of our favorite stories from Jesus, such as the stories of the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son.
Exactly right. Like I said, fully 50% of what we Luke gives us is not in any other gospel, and the bulk of that, or a significant portion of that, are some of the parables that we wouldn't know about otherwise. The parable of the rich fool is another example. You've mentioned the Good Samaritan is one. The publican sinner is another. The rich man and Lazarus is another. There are a whole slew of parabolic teachings that Luke alone is responsible for. There's also a whole series of teachings about how we handle money and wealth that is unique to Luke as well. So obviously he's an important writer who tells us an awful lot about Jesus that we wouldn't know otherwise.
And as well, we can add in with the data aspect that Luke has been said to be a great historian, that he really pinpoints the times and dates of the events that he talks about, doesn't he?
Yes, he does in spots give us, in fact, if we didn't have Acts, in many cases, we wouldn't be able to date some of the events that are alluded to in the epistles and that kind of thing. So this material does help us kind of locate the chronological flow of events in the early church. It's important to us for that reason as well. I mean, they're just, once we start talking about this, we could conceivably spend the entire 2 hours talking about how important Luke is for what he gives us, and because he is just about that important. He is a central part of the New Testament canon and certainly one of its major contributors.
Well, let's start talking about him as a person. We'll have a start. Now, to be sure, let's hear this straight from the source here, that it is unanimously agreed that whoever wrote Luke, Acts, the same person wrote both of them, right?
There's been a little bit of debate in the last 50 years about whether or not it's the same person in the same work, but attempts to sever the hyphen, if you will, between Luke and Acts really has not been viewed as successful. The two volumes are very tightly woven together in terms of theme, in terms of parallels between Jesus and the apostles, the way in which the ascension closes the gospel and links the beginning, the way in which the prologue alludes back to the earlier work. There are a variety of things that point to a unified perspective and a unified treatment of the theme across two volumes. And so I would say it's nearly unanimous. I couldn't honestly say it's unanimous, but it's nearly unanimous. But it's one of those things where the skeptics are very much on the shorter side of this argument.
Now, someone like Bart Ehrman, well, we're coming to tell us that the Gospel of Luke is anonymous, and so is the Book of Acts, for that matter. So we really have no basis, then, for thinking that Luke wrote it. I'm guessing you don't agree with that.
You're right about that. It is true that all the Gospels, in fact, are anonymous. No writer appends his name to the material that he writes for any of the Gospels. So the evidence that we assemble for who the writer is a combination of features internally that tell us what the types of things the author's interested in and the type of setting that he wrote to, as well as the tradition in the early church that we can date back as far as the early part of the second century, which is not that far removed from when these books were written, if you think about it. And this idea that people don't think about, and that is that when these books were originally sent to these churches and began to be read in them, I think it's very hard to believe that they would have been read in the churches without a knowledge of where they came from. And so even though the author doesn't append his name to the work, because authors oftentimes didn't do that in the ancient world, they're not the issue, the story that they're telling is the issue, the church would not have circulated what they did and said what they did without some knowledge of what's going on. Martin Hingle, who taught New Testament at Tübingen, in fact, was my host there, wrote a book years ago talking about the superscriptions that come with the manuscripts above the Gospels, and the phrase is the Gospel according to, using the preposition kata in Greek. And he makes the point that he thinks these superscriptions, one, have to be pretty early, end of first century, early second century, and second, began to be appended to these manuscripts to distinguish one gospel from the other, because you had a gospel now written by Matthew, a gospel now written by Mark, a gospel now written by Luke, and a gospel now written by John. So which one are we talking about? So, and he thinks that these traditional ascriptions to the manuscripts are very, very early and come with some solid tradition behind them. There are other reasons why we think that Luke is the writer, having to do with the way in which Paul is portrayed in Acts, the fact that we've got a we figure who's alluded to at certain points in Acts, and when we boil that down to who that could be, there are only a handful of Pauline people who accompanied Paul who could fit the we, and then once we go through that list, we can whittle it down. Luke is one of a handful of people who could possibly be in that group. And so you put that together with the tradition, and voila, we have our author.
You know, I also think it's important to keep in mind that if the early church didn't know who wrote this and we were trying to think of a person they could ascribe this gospel to, they wouldn't like to go and say, oh, here's this guy who's talked about a little bit in the Pauline epistles. His name is Luke. Yeah, let's use him.
Yeah, I think the same actually also applies to Mark in relationship to the second gospel, and this is an argument worth working through. If Luke is not the author of Luke Acts, okay, and remember when the name gets attached to him, he's not known as the author of this work, okay, then what does he have to commend himself? Well, he's one of many people who accompanied Paul throughout his ministry, and the only other thing we know about him is he was a doctor. That's it. We don't know very much else about him at all. And so so the idea that you're going to pick Luke out of the hat, out of all these figures that you could, and remember that the argument is you attach the name to the gospel to enhance its status. That's why you do it. You want to lift up the status of this anonymous work by attaching it to someone who's known. There are lots of other people you could have attached this work to for whom that would have worked conceivably much better. And you wouldn't have picked the name Luke out of this hat. This argument works, as I said, especially also for the Gospel of Mark. If you had the choice between attributing the Gospel of Mark to Mark or attributing the Gospel of Mark to Peter, which the tradition would allow you to do, because Papias says that Mark took Peter's preaching and wrote about it. You would pick Peter before you'd pick Mark to enhance the status of that gospel in the drop of a hat. Look at Mark's resume. He went home to mama in the first missionary journey. He didn't make it through. He caused a fight and a split between Paul and Barnabas. Okay, that's our commendation for the writer of the second gospel, and that's how we're going to lift up its status by attaching it to a name of someone who's really well-known and who give it stature. That doesn't give it any stature at all. Now, Mark is connected with the gospel because Mark was associated with the gospel in the tradition, even though that association in the tradition also connected him to Peter. If you wanted to lift up the status of the gospel, you would have lifted it up by calling it the gospel of Peter, and the tradition doesn't just how careful the tradition is in these areas.
There's an excellent book that goes into that some that I recommend to my readers, and I'm sure you'd agree with the recommendation, called Reinventing Jesus by Wallace, Sawyer, and Komazewski. But mm-hmm. to get back to what you said also, you said that many ancient works in the ancient world were anonymous. I understand that Plutarch's biographies, for instance, are anonymous. Can you tell us in the other works that we're certain of who wrote them, but they don't have their names on them?
No, I can't tell you off the top of my head that, but the Plutarch is a good example that often is brought forward.
Okay, thank you. And we also need to talk then about Luke. If he wrote this, he was the only Gentile who wrote in the New Testament, wasn't he?
Yes, we think he's the only Gentile. Again, here we're responding to the end of the book of Colossians, Colossians 4, where he is described as one who's not of the circumcision. So he would be the one Gentile writer that we have. He shows terrific sensitivity to God-fearers and to Gentiles. In his two volumes, he tells the story about how the gospel made it to the Gentiles. And so, yes, I think he is a Gentile, and he also is explaining how the gospel got to Gentiles. In fact, I actually think this is one of the points of Luke Acts as a whole, is to explain to Theophilus, who I also think is a Gentile, possibly a God-fearer, possibly someone who came to the Christian community through having been a God-fearer in the synagogue to begin with, and he's now questioning whether he's made the right decision. Has the church gone too far? Is that why she's being persecuted? Is the church done something in Jew-Gentile relationships that shouldn't be done? And so is that why there's so much negative happening to the church? And Luke is writing to reassure him, no, God was behind this all along the way. The reaching out of the gospel by Peter to Cornelius was something God was responsible for, and that becomes the core argument in the middle part of Acts for why it is the gospel went to Gentiles. The gospel went to Gentiles because God had always intended that the gospel be taken to Gentiles.
Okay, let's try and get in one more question for a break, since you brought up Theophilus. Now, writing in the ancient world was a pretty expensive deal to do, and since Luke wrote most of more of what's in the New Testament than anyone else, he had to spend a pretty good penny to get all that writing done, and not just the writing, but all the research done. Could it be that Theophilus was also the patron who sponsored Luke's writing? I've heard, I've heard all these gospels going around, all these stories going around. I want you to go out there and find what's the real deal. What can I believe in? Is that a possible theory?
It's conceivable that Theophilus is the patron here. It's certainly the case that Theophilus is the one to whom the work is dedicated. And again, Luke is a doctor. He writes with a very advanced style of Greek. He seems to have come from a higher social level, generally speaking, than the rest or many of the rest of the disciples. And so it seems like he did have access to some means by which to produce this gospel. And whether Theophilus underwrote it or whether Luke undertook it because he knew it would circulate in high social circles, because he addresses Theophilus with a reference of respect in addressing him in the prologue, That we can't know for sure on the one side of the question, but we can certainly know that it was dedicated to him, and that he is the focus of the writing.
Okay, well, with that, we're going to go ahead and take our first break. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Daryl Bach, talking about the Gospel of Luke today and who Luke was. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back. My guest is Daryl Bach from Dallas Theological Seminary. We're talking about the Gospel of Luke today, and as well as some of Acts 2. Those two are kind of connected very much. Now, what genre is Luke? This can be a debated question. Some want to say it's kind of a sui generis, where it's its own genre. Some want to say that it's a Greco-Roman biography. Some say it's a historiography. What is it?
All of the above. It certainly in the gospel section is an example of ancient biography. In the second section, it's what we might call an ethnography. In other words, it's the story of the origins of a people movement. And so it's a community document in Acts telling the history of the rise and the origins of the church. So it's a mixed genre for sure, because the genre of Luke and the genre of Acts aren't the same, but both are historiographical writings. They are different genre within categories of ancient history.
Okay, and
that's about as short an answer as you're probably going to get from me today.
Yeah. It looks like we've got someone already who's willing to call in and ask a question. Are you wanting to take a question now?
Sure, we'd be glad to.
Okay. Carlo, you are on the air with Daryl Bach. Hello? Well, okay, I'm going to let that one go then. But if someone wants to call in the question, the number is 714-242-5180. Now, with that, we also need to ask, when was Luke Acts written? What data do we really have to determine that? Because a lot of skeptics will tell us it's around 80 to 85, and more conservatives will say, no, it was written probably in the 60s or so. When do we date Luke and then Acts?
This is actually, I think, a harder question, because either date, it seems to me, is possible. My own tendency is still to put it in the 60s, but this dating is really tied to two issues. One is the date of Luke's relationship to the other Gospels that he used, and the second is tied to what you think about how the events in the predictions of the Olivet Discourse and the destruction of the temple in AD 70 work. Of those two, by far the more important is the dating, the relative dating in relationship to the other Gospels. And so Luke's dating, to some degree, is tied to what you think about Mark, because for most people, Luke has used Mark. He's kept the general Mark and outline, and he's using Mark. He's following Mark. Now, Mark's date itself is discussed anywhere from being in the 50s, late 50s, to as late as the late 60s. Some people will put it after the destruction of Jerusalem, but I think that's unlikely. And Mark, because of its emphasis on persecution, really fits a date in the 60s. The first great Roman persecution of the church came under Nero in the period of his rule, running up to 64. And so that's actually a good fit. So then the question becomes, how long would it take Luke to get a hold of Mark and turn it around and produce his own gospel? Other people will put the date of Mark closer to the pressure that came on Jews as a whole, as well as Christians, in the run-up to the war that the Jews had with Rome that led to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. If you push Mark's date to the latter part of the 60s, then you've got Luke writing on the other end. And then the other feature that comes into play here is Luke doesn't allude directly to the destruction of Jerusalem in his writing. So if he writes after 70, he writes far enough away from AD 70 that the trauma of the event no longer has to be talked about, kind of like how we think about 9/11. So we've either got a date in the 60s or in the 80s. Most who favor the date in the 60s will argue that Acts ends with Paul in Rome in the early 60s, and that's the last event that's referred to, so that's a clue as to when the Luke Acts was written. Luke written slightly before the early part of the 60s, Acts written up into the 60s. There is a problem with that argument, and that is that the narrative flow of Acts really has the storyline drive that the goal is to get the gospel to Rome. So once Paul gets to Rome with the gospel and begins to share it, he's reached the goal of the book. And so then the question becomes, does Luke stop writing because that's the last event he knows about and that's where we're at, or does Luke stop writing because he's reached his narrative goal? People who think he's reached his narrative goal don't take what's going on in Acts 28 as a clue to when Acts was written. So you put all those factors together, I still think you're more likely to be in the 60s than you are to be in the 80s, but either of those dates is possible. I said the second feature is what gets said about the Olivet Discourse. This has to do with whether or not the Gospels give clues about whether AD 70 has already happened by the way they give those discourses. That argument can come in two forms. It's important, a distinction. One is, well, Jesus couldn't predict ahead on a kind of a naturalist reading of the Olivet Discourse. But there's another argument that says there are clues in the writing by the way the siege is described and that kind of thing that shows that they're aware of what took place, not predictive, but have given detail that shows that it's already taken place. I think both of those are problematic. I think Jesus can predict the surrounding and destruction of Jerusalem in siege terms, because he understands that Israel is covenantally unfaithful. If you're covenantally unfaithful in the Old Testament, you risk having the nations come into the land and taking it over, and you're going into exile, those kinds of things. So if Jesus is just a good Jew who thinks that Israel is covenantally unfaithful, he can predict that Rome could be a means of judgment that God would use against the nation. And then the way the Romans work when they are... aggressors is they siege cities. So Jesus just needs to be observant in order to make the kinds of predictions that he makes about the temple in the Olivet Discourse. So I don't think that second argument, which sometimes appears as a basis for dating, has any substance.
We can also keep in mind that C.S. Lewis said that if you approach the text and you say, well, prophecy can't happen, therefore this must be dated later, that you're no longer really doing literary criticism. You're doing metaphysics at that point. And so unless you can back that claim, your argument really doesn't have the force that it could have.
Yes, and the argument that I used about Jesus being a good Jew who could kind of see the handwriting on the wall is a way of giving substance to Lewis's comment, because that's a historical observation that one can make about thinking through how it is that Jesus could see this ahead of time. In other words, you don't even have to go to the metaphysical level in order to make the case that Jesus could make the kind of prediction that he does about the destruction of Jerusalem.
There are some people who might react also to what you said about how Luke liked to use the Gospel of Mark, and of course there are some in the Christian community think that where if Luke's writing Scripture and that's Word of God, why would he need to rely on a source like Mark?
Well, for two reasons. One, he tells us that he's aware of what's been written. He tells us that in the prologue to his gospel. And secondly, because this material, once it's written and circulating in the church, would have been material that was circulating in the church and that the church had a regard for. So, particularly if it has apostolic sanction. If Mark is writing because Mark has access to Peter, then that story of Jesus has status from the very start. And so so it isn't an idea of saying, I'm going to write a gospel and I'm not going to listen to what anyone else has to say about Jesus. It's very much a case that Luke says, I'm very aware of what's been said about Jesus, and here is the account that I'm going to give.
Some writers in the Christian community wonder why Matthew and Luke both would use Mark and oftentimes use them verbatim. But I think you just gave us a very important clue that just what I've said about is that Mark has kind of established the first written Jesus tradition, and Luke and Matthew both want to build on that in many cases and not detract from it. And so in their writings, they're going to use, even verbatim sometimes, a number of words and stories that Mark uses to build up the tradition that way. Does that seem accurate to you?
Yes, and especially if it's understood in the church that the roots for what Mark is saying comes from Peter. Then you've got a very tight apostolic association for this material, which probably would have been circulating before it was written down by Mark in some form of an oral collection as well.
In fact, Luke pretty much tells us that, doesn't he, in his prologue?
Exactly right. He talks about those who have undertaken by hand to write an account of the Gospels, and then those who were eyewitnesses and ministers of the Word. So verse 1 is about written accounts, and verse 2 is about oral accounts. And he says they're both out there. And so what he's done is he's kind of sat down and collected what he's aware of and has put his own account to writing. That's what the prologue is all about.
So many skeptics we meet today will say, well, Luke says he does this, but Luke never cites his sources, so why should we think that he's being reliable here?
Well, this has to do with just your general take on how Luke is a historical writer. And what's interesting is that in the places where we can check Luke against the historical and cultural background, we can show how careful he is. We can also watch Luke cite himself. I like to use the example, if you want to know how tradition gets passed on orally, I like to use the example of the three tellings of how the Lord appeared to Paul. That appears in Acts 9, in Acts 22, and in Acts 26. It's the same writer writing all three, and yet in each account there are things that are consistently the same, and there also are things that give us new angles on what took place. We've got this mixture of gist and variation that we see. And that's also what you see in the way Luke handles the gospel materials tied to Jesus. In fact, one of the things that's said about Luke when you compare the Markan sections to Mark is how careful Luke is in relating what it is that Mark has told us. So he seemed to be a conservative preserver of tradition by the practice that we can check. And that gives, I think, some measure of expectation that we can trust Luke in terms of how he handles his sources.
And let's say a little bit about that oral tradition here to clarify some matters on it. And I do think if people want to hear even more, listen to the show where I interviewed Brent Sandy, and co-author of The Lost World of Scripture. But someone like Bart Ehrman, again, will come and say, well, someone hears this story, and then they become a Christian. They go off and tell someone else the story, and that person becomes a Christian, and then that person goes off and tells someone else, and that person becomes a Christian. And it's just like the game of telephone. In the oral tradition, the story just gets garbled up entirely. And I'm guessing you also don't agree with that.
That's right. And, I really like the name of this game that you get in Australia and in Asia. They call it Chinese Whispers, and it has this feel to it. The problem with Ehrman's example is that he's talking about unsupervised oral tradition, a tradition that simply just floats. There's no control on it. There's no oversight of it. Whatever. He totally ignores the role of the apostles and the function that leaders in the church had to circulate information that came through the churches. And what we know about the apostles is that their qualifications for ministry were very much tied to their familiarity with Jesus. Remember that when Judas is replaced in Acts 1, the qualification for being an apostle is that someone had to be with Jesus from the very beginning, i.e. they really had to know him. And the reason for that is that they had responsibility and oversight for the traditions that circulated through the churches. The stuff that we're getting in the Gospels is material that was circulating through the churches. It's not what parishioners are talking about. And so Ken Bailey, who's done very careful study of oral tradition in Bedouin cultures, talks about how corporate oral tradition works. That is, oral tradition that is overseen by a people and where people, a group of people, care about the content. And he talks about the fact that it's what he calls it informal but controlled. And the point that he's making is anyone can tell the story, okay, provided they know the story, but there's a control over it. There are elders in Bedouin communities who, if someone mistells the story, will correct it and make sure that people hear the correct story. That's the model, Bailey argues, is operating in the church. It's not the rabbinic model, which is a word-for-word model, and it's not the uncontrolled model that Ehrman is arguing for, or that, say, Rudolf Bultmann argued for example. It's something very much in between, but it is overseen, and it's overseen in a way in which the contents, people are keeping an eye on the contents, because there's something at stake in the way the story is being told.
I'd like to go back to what you said about the conversion of Paul. I got a quote from E.P. Sanders on here in his book, The Historical Figure of Jesus, where he says this: "The author of Luke Acts was not stupid. He doubtless knew that his stories varied. He could have told the same story the same way, but that would not have been as good a narrative. Like many other authors, both ancient and modern, he disliked repetition. Like other ancient authors, he would change the events in order to avoid it." Now, what do you think about that overall?
Well, I think you get some variation, but the key here is that the gist of these stories is the same. You get fresh details with each telling. I like to make a couple of points about this kind of category. You know, if you ask my wife about our courtship and you ask me about our courtship, you will get likely some of the same events. You'll also get other events that she'll refer to that I won't, or that I'll refer to that she won't. If you put us in a room together to talk about this, then you've got the opportunity to kind of compare accounts. But if we each write separately our accounts, you're going to get overlap. You're also going to get distinctive pieces. And that's what you see between the various Gospels. And difference doesn't necessarily equal contradiction. It's simply a difference. Another example, the same kind of thing that I like to use as an illustration for this, because remember, we're dealing with a world primarily of orality, where people tell stories and they pass them on by word of mouth as opposed to writing them down. That's how they're used to passing on information. Is the situation you get when someone dies and everyone gathers together with the family. And what normally happens in that kind of a setting is people tell the stories of what they remember about the person who's died, usually to communicate their respect and regard or what they remember about them, etc. And when you're in a room full of people where there are a variety of people, you might have someone else who is at the same event who will tell additional things that they're aware of, etc. Well, imagine a writer coming along and kind of trying to summarize that kind of a conversation. He's going to have the ability not just to tell the story once, but in some cases to repeat the story, and repeat the story from a different angle each time, dealing with the contributions of different people at different points if he wants to do it that way. And I think that's what you see in the appearance to Paul's story, for example. And what you see is there's no doubt that core story is the same. Jesus appeared to Paul and called him into a ministry to Gentiles. All three of those stories are making that same key point. All three are serving that purpose. But then there are other things about it that are a little bit different in each case because we're reflecting some difference. Plus, the other thing is, just for the sheer rhetorical value of retelling the story and giving us something fresh to keep the story sort of fresh, even though it's being repeated, is also a feature that's going on.
We're going to take a my break a little bit early because I don't think there's enough time for another question before a break. But I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Daryl Bach. We're talking about the Gospel of Luke and the work of Acts today. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. We're talking with Daryl Bach about the Gospel of Luke and the work of Acts today. Now let's start diving into the Gospel a little bit. And the first four verses, the Lucan prologue, they are of immense significance, aren't they?
Yes, they are the one place where a Gospel writer tells us how they went about writing and what they did. I mean, we have a purpose statement in John that tells us why he wrote that Gospel. We don't have anything equivalent to it in Matthew or in Mark that talks about why they've done what they've done. So this is the one text where a Gospel writer kind of tells us what's going on that's led him to write. And what he tells us in verse 1 is that many have undertaken to compile an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. That's referring to handwritten presentations of who Jesus is. Like the accounts passed on to us, that's technical terminology for oral tradition, by those who are eyewitnesses and servants of the word from the beginning, making the point not only that these oral accounts are rooted in eyewitnesses, but in people who really walked and talked with Jesus from the start. And then in verse 3, Luke says he adds himself to the mix. So it seemed good to me as well, because I followed all things carefully from the beginning, to write an orderly account. By the way, that's not necessarily chronologically orderly, but it's orderly in terms of the geographic progression of Jesus' ministry and the history of the early church. Most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know for certain the things about which you have been taught. He's trying to reassure Theophilus about the things that he's heard. For the reasons I suggested earlier, that is that I think that Theophilus is wondering whether he can trust the things that he's heard or not.
Now, do we have any parallels to this in the Greco-Roman world and any other writings? I think Loveday Alexander has done a lot of work in this regard. So is this an exceptional case, or is Luke using a conventional methodology that his readers would recognize and thus know about what kind of writing they're going to be reading?
No, sometimes prologues are a part of a writing. I mean, Josephus has a prologue in some of his writings. The prologue that I'm drawn to in relationship to Luke is one in 2 Maccabees that goes through an explanation for why the author is writing. So this is not that uncommon. It would be... you don't have to have one, obviously, but having one is not unexpected either.
Now, in this, Luke tells us that he interviews many eyewitnesses, and that means that he himself was not an eyewitness, correct?
Yeah, it isn't so much that he said that he interviewed eyewitnesses as much as he's saying, this is how people are hearing about Jesus. People are hearing about Jesus from eyewitnesses and those who were with him from the beginning, and I think that Luke is among those who have heard these accounts. And yes, when he separates himself from the eyewitnesses and servants of the word, the impression is left, I think that's the way you have to say it, that he himself is not an eyewitness. Had he been an eyewitness, I think this would have been a perfect time for him to lump himself in that group, and he doesn't do it.
Yeah, already I'm sure several in the more skeptical community will say, well, gee, that's the reason why we shouldn't be able to trust him, because we need to have an eyewitness account of what's written. That without that, all we got is just hearsay right here.
Yeah, and again, this is why the earlier question you asked me about sources is important, because we can see how Luke handles his sources, and he handles them conservatively.
So, but the thing about him not being an eyewitness, in the ancient world, that really wouldn't matter so much, would it?
Most writings that we have of ancient history that we're comfortable with and we accept are written by writers coming much, much later, dealing with a much longer stream of oral tradition. tradition as they write. You know, Luke is really within the period of contemporaries who are talking about these events. But a lot of historical writings are writing a century, two, three later about the events that they record. And if we handled the classics the way many skeptics handle the New Testament, we would have to shut down a lot of classics departments.
We had Paul Meyer on the show back in November 30th, and that's the same kind of consensus I reached, where he said that many of the colleagues he works with in ancient history are far kinder to the New Testament than most skeptics out there are.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
There are going to be some people who do say they do have some concerns, because Luke seems to make some mistakes that seem pretty apparent. And one of the first ones we're going to immediately go to with that is the census in Luke 2, because how can you date that since everything about that seems to be wrong?
Well, yeah, I think this is the most difficult historical problem in the Gospel of Luke. And because all the extra-biblical evidence that we have places this census in association with the transition away from Archelaus to a Roman prefect ruling the area by directly. And that is a 6 AD date, and the date we have for Jesus' birth, because of the association with the time of Herod the Great, has to be before that, about 4 to 6 BC is the way that works. We might ask a question later, how can the Christ be born before the Christ, but I won't deal with that now. And so what I actually think is going on is that we've got to remember that we're dealing with ancient times here. We're not dealing with modern communication, internet, the time of instant calculation, et cetera. And we're also dealing with governments. My suggestion in dealing with this problem is that Rome worked up to this census, and they applied it during the time when they brought the ruler in directly, and it became associated with AD 6. But it actually took them a long time to do everything associated with this over a long period of time. Now, that's my solution to the problem. Other people will say that the way in which the expression tying it to Quirinius, when Quirinius was governor of Syria, which would also have been a later period, has been mistranslated, and it should be translated before the time when Quirinius was governor, as opposed to at the time when Quirinius is governor. That would also work.
Ben Witherington was on our show, I think it was on December 7th, and I think that last track is the one that he gave out. These were events that describing what took place before a great census in AD 6, because the Greek apparently is kind of ambiguous at that point.
That's correct. The Greek is ambiguous. The problem is that the census that everybody knows about and the census that Josephus talks about is clearly a census that was applied in 6 AD. And so, like I said, I think that this is my own sense is that this took place over a period of time, and the name Quirinius became associated with it because he's the one who applied it.
What would you say, though, to the skeptic out there who's looking at the Gospel of Luke saying, I'm going to trust Luke. I'm very not sure of this one. I'm not sure if the explanation applies. I mean, I just shouldn't trust Luke at all. If he's still not sure which argument to go with, what would you say to someone who's skeptical about the whole Gospel because of this mistake?
Well, I think, I don't think this is an all or nothing operation. I think that you could sit down and take a work like Colin Hemer wrote on Acts of the Apostles, where he literally goes through dozens of examples where Luke is very, very accurate to underscore the credibility of Luke and to underscore why it is that even many classicists, when they read Luke Acts, trust the material that Luke is putting forward. There's just not the basis for the level of skepticism that some people bring to a conversation like this.
Now, as we move through the second chapter of Luke even more, I think Paul Meyer did say he thinks that Mary could have been a source of what Luke said, because so much of what was said would somehow trace back to Mary. So if Mary was a Mistwarzer, it was someone who knew Mary, because she talks about how she pondered these things in her heart when they happened. And the only way someone could really know that is if they heard it from the source.
Well, you've been successful in getting me to have a really short answer. I agree. I think Meyer is right here. I'm suspicious that at least the chain of the tradition that's represented here goes back to Mary, or at least to Mary's family.
And we could say along these lines about sources is Richard Bauckham, when he writes about the different women at the resurrection in each gospel, he says that the reason different women are named is because in each case those women are the sources that we offer you. So perhaps we could do the same thing with Luke, and when Luke mentions a specific name of someone, he's pretty much saying, this is who I talked to. You can go back, you can check, you can see and talk to them yourself.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable with that kind of a reconstruction in terms of what's going on. I don't think these traditions would have been maintained in the church unless there was some confidence about where they came from.
And then we can also look at even what could be considered enemy attestation in there. For instance, in Luke 7, Jesus goes to the home of Simon the Pharisee, who does not treat Jesus properly like a friend should. And the story is entirely embarrassing to Simon. He's humiliated because he hasn't shown the proper honor to a guest. And when Luke says Simon the Pharisee and where he lives, this would be someone who would be well known to the readers. And he's saying, hey, yeah, you can go and talk to even Simon. Even Simon knows that this happened. There are people at this dinner party. They all know that this is what happened.
Yeah, this is a harder one in some ways because it's hard to know exactly where Luke's original audience is located as to whether or not they could have inquired on someone like Simon, but at least theoretically it could work. Like I say, it's more a function of the setting and where this would have been distributed as to how confident we could be that the people would have access to someone who's the source of a story like this.
And since Luke knows these people, could we think that it's quite likely that when Paul was in prison in the Jerusalem area for a time, that that's when Luke would have been running around the area, talking to as many people as he could and finding as much information as he could, and so he'd know all these people that he writes about?
I'm not sure if we need to have a model that says that Luke had direct conversations with all the people that he wrote about. He may only have access to the traditions that do exist within the church that discuss these events, and he may well just simply trust the nature of the tradition that he has access to in the church. So I'm not seeing Luke running around like a CNN reporter collecting info. I mean, he's doing this some, but I don't think he has to do it in every case.
Okay. Now, when we look at Luke's gospel, you've mentioned that Gentiles are prominent, and you've also pointed out the poor. But Luke's gospel, I think, has also been called the gospel of women as well, because he really places women in a prominent light. Would you agree with that as well?
No, absolutely. One of the features that he has that he talks about much more than the other gospel writers are the variety of women who have a unique role. You know, we've got Elizabeth, the wife of John the Baptist. We've got Anna, the prophetess. We've got discussions about Martha and Mary that we don't have anywhere else. We've got numerous women in Acts who are alluded to at different points. So, yes, he has many examples where women are present, and he also has lots of passages where he'll have a male example, and then he'll have a female example. So, for example, we have the example of Simon, who's responsible for the Nunc Dimittis in Luke 2, followed by Anna. Or we get the example of, this one is, we get a counterexample of the Pharisees and how they give their money at the temple, and the poor widow who gives her money, who is the example, that kind of thing. There's a lot of that going on in the two volumes.
Actually, the first one that I thought of was Prisca and Aquila.
Yes, they operate together side by side as a couple, and actually Prisca has the lead role in that particular pairing, which is interesting. So that's another example of the same type, although what I have in mind here are not so much characters who minister together as pieces of stories that are told with a male and female element side by side. Another example of the same thing. In Luke 15, you've got the shepherd going and pursuing the lost sheep, but then the next example is the woman who loses her coin, who finds it. And so you get this male-female juxtaposition with the two very much equated in how they are interacting with the theme in question. That's something Luke consistently does.
And then there's also the story in Luke 10 with Mary and Martha together, and one of them is sitting and listening to Jesus. I mean, everyone's doing all the housework, which was important to do for guests, and says, "Lord, won't you make my sister come help me?" And the Lord rebukes her, which would have been an extraordinary thing to say. You know, the women don't need to just stay and do all the housework. They're just as fine to sit down and listen to the message of Jesus as the men are.
Yes, and this passage is really interesting because, as you know, Greek can signal what the answer to the question should be when it asks the question. And that's the case here. When Martha complains, she says, in effect, "Surely you care that she fully expects him to respond positively to and intervene." And, of course, he refuses to do so by saying that she's made the better choice, that Mary has made the better choice by sitting at his feet. And in the context of Judaism, it was debated in the Second Temple period whether a woman should be taught Torah or not, some favoring it, others not. So Jesus is clearly taking a stand in terms of women being full disciples. Another key point where women are seen to be full disciples, this is something all the Gospels, all the Synoptic Gospels share, in fact all the Gospels share it, is that the first witnesses of the empty tomb were women. They're the one whose report leads to the appreciation of the fact that God actually has vindicated Jesus through resurrection.
Now, since Luke is supposed to be a doctor as well, highlight is often given the way that Luke writes about the healing stories of Jesus, that he has a special interest in seeing healing taking place. What do we learn from Luke about the healing of Jesus?
Well, this is one that's discussed among scholars as to whether this is particularly peculiar to Luke because he's a doctor or whether he, because he writes with some detail, simply includes details about healing that are the natural language of talking about those kinds of topics. And to be honest, it's hard to know which is going on. Does he have this sensitivity because he's a doctor, or is he simply relaying the details of these events that happen to involve these particular features because he's dealing with healing? I think the case could be said he's sensitive to the details perhaps because he's a doctor, but it may well be that the tradition has some of those details in it as well, and he may be doing nothing more than passing on what the topic was about.
One aspect of Luke's gospel that does contain medical information is disputed as to whether it should be in the text or not, is when Jesus is in the garden and the angel comes, supposedly, and ministers to him and says, "His sweat was as drops of blood," which does describe a medical condition, I believe, called hematidrosis, but it's disputed whether that belongs in the text or not. What do you think about that?
I actually think we may be guilty of overreading this text. I think the text, the manuscript, has this detail in it. I think the likelihood of it not being there is not very great. But when he says that he sweats like drops of blood, I think the point is not that he's sweating blood, but he's sweating like drops of blood falling to the ground. It's a comparison. So I think when people picture Jesus as being so anxious that in effect he has the equivalent of a nosebleed, maybe overreading the text.
Well, I've got something else to ask about that, but for now we're going to take a quick break. I am Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. My guest from Dallas Theological Seminary today is Daryl Brock. We're talking about the work of Luke Acts, and he'll be here off to the end of the show. But if you're here next week, my guest is going to be Charles Hill. And we're going to be talking about two books that he's got out, one that he's edited, the early text of the New Testament, and one that he wrote called Who Chose the Gospels. And in fact, he could be here the very week after, along with some others, because we could have a show talking about the book How God Became Jesus, which I am reading right now. You're nice enough to send me a copy for the show, and he'd be joining us with a few of the other co-authors. So that's just a little preview of what's coming up ahead. So now,
oh, Nick, so how did God become Jesus?
Well, the authors, of course, don't think that God did become Jesus, literally, but they're responding to the Ehrman book that's coming out about how Jesus became God, and saying, no, Ehrman just doesn't have his facts right here.
Yeah, I'm well aware of what's coming down the pike. It's our typical release that comes right before Easter and or Christmas that challenges some aspect of the Christian faith.
Yeah, I made the whole Aragorn meme yesterday, and it's been pretty popular on the internet with saying, brace yourselves, atheists are about to become experts in Christology.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to happen. I've been on Peter Boghossian's Facebook page, for instance, and see him bring up misquoting Jesus and saying, yeah, the apologists won't respond to this one. And I was like, yeah, you want to bet? We've made waste of that one there. And because so many skeptics need to do is just read Ehrman, read Carrier, read anyone else, and by golly, they know it all then.
Yeah, and you know, that's really the point of the Truth Matters book, is that what we've done is we've taken each of Bart Ehrman's books released up to this point, made a topic out of each one of them, and responded with what we are saying is the other half of the story that you're not hearing about in the public square echo chamber about these things, and trying to fill in the gaps and really prepare young people for what they're going to hear on college campuses if they go to an early Christianity class. And Ehrman's introduction to the New Testament is a text, or something like it is a text, which is very, very common. And so we find the church isn't preparing people adequately in this regard, and some people think there are no answers when, in fact, there are.
Now, we're not going to spend the rest of the show talking about, because you and I are in communication about having you come back on. Sometimes we can devote a whole show to the book, but tell us a little bit about Truth Matter. It's been like, when's it going to come out, and what are topics?
It's out. It's been out a couple of weeks. It's very available on places like Amazon.com and or a Christian bookstore. It deals with the whole attractiveness of the skeptical approach to Scripture and what's going on in the public square. The opening chapter, I think, is entitled Skepticism 101. And then we go through and isolate issues like, does God believe in the what do you do with the problem of evil? That's the first one. We deal with the issue of New Testament manuscripts and New Testament textual criticism. We deal with the theory of alternative Christianities. We deal with the idea the Bible's full of contradictions. Focus primarily on the New Testament because that's what Ehrman writes about. And we go through where did the canon come from. So, you know, these kind of big conversations. And then this is a popular volume. It's written for parents, youth leaders, pastors, et cetera, just to orient them to the discussion, kind of get it started. And then in 6 months, we're going to do another more detailed kind of blood and gore version called Truth in a Culture of Doubt, which will put a paper trail on a lot of the stuff that we're mentioning in Truth Matters. Truth Matters, the subtitle is something to the effect of confident faith in a confusing world. Yep.
I see it right here on Amazon. If anyone's interested in it, the Kindle version looks to be $8.54. The hardcover is $8.99, and you've written it with a few co-authors as well.
That's right. Andreas Kostenberger, who, of course, is a research professor of New Testament at Southeastern, good friend, and Josh Chatra, one of his students who is a pastor, does a lot of youth work in Dublin, Georgia, and was a doctoral student with Andreas. They actually wrote the original draft of this and then asked me after they had gotten started to join in with them, and so I went through it and made additions as well and comments, et cetera, and then the three of us worked on it together. The other thing that's unusual about the book is we're really engaged with a certain kind of tone. We say truth matters, but so does tone, and what we mean by that is many people who have questions and who've never darkened the door of a church have the questions that they have because of what they've heard in the public square. Their questions are actually quite honest. It doesn't come with the skepticism with which a professor writes. It's simply a reflection of the fact that they've lived in an echo chamber where all they've heard about is what is said about Christianity culturally. And so I think it's very important to respect that about the questions that you get as you engage, and not just assume that there's a hostility on the person asking these kinds of questions, because what they're picking up and reflecting is nothing but mirroring all that they've heard. And I think that's an important feature in thinking about how to engage on these topics with people who were like I was when I was in college, which is I wasn't hostile to Christianity. It was just all I had heard about it. And so the questions I had were natural questions given what I had been exposed to.
Okay. And when is the next book coming out after Truth Matters, and what's it called again?
The next book will be called Truth in a Culture of Doubt, and I think it's due for a September release. I may be off a month or two, but it's certainly going to be in the fall of the year. It's running 6 months behind this current release.
Well, I've just checked on Amazon, it looks like it's due to come out September 1st, 2014, and you and any of your fellow co-authors are indeed welcome to come back and discuss that book if you want to.
We'd love to. I mean, it's, this is a topic that's dear to us because we also think the other thing that's gone on here is that the church doesn't do a very good job of preparing its young people for these conversations, and I think part of the fault of why we lose people once they go to university is in fact our failure to adequately prepare people for these kinds of questions. We have a segment of the church that likes to seal people away from these kinds of questions and things that raise questions about the Bible, and in the long run, I think that's counterproductive.
Yes, I agree. This has been a battle I've been fighting for several years now, and nothing has hardly as disappointed me when I go to a church and say, hey, I'd be glad to give you some projects, training, teach some classes here, there, give a message, whatever. I won't even charge you. Just let me do it. And they just say, nah, we don't really need that right now. And I'm just going, yeah, you really do need it. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a shame that people are so unaware of the fact that I actually do a whole class that's built around this. I changed the way I taught introduction at the seminary from being, an introduction to the New Testament, and the joke among students is, well, this is just about great white dead European heretics, to introduction in the public square, in which I tried to show that virtually every issue that comes up has been reflected in a documentary or is discussed on the net, that kind of thing. And my point is that millions of people are exposed to these points of view, your neighbors, your friends. Someone walks in talking about the Gospel of Thomas, and they go, I don't know anything about this. Why is that? Well, it's because this stuff is floating around in the public square, and we're totally oblivious to it. And most pastors don't know how to even begin to engage on this stuff other than to say, that's skeptical, that's liberal, that's wrong. That may satisfy the Christian who doesn't want to engage, but that's useless in equipping them for interacting with the people who are raising these questions.
Well, we could spend the rest of the time talking about this kind of thing, but that's what the next show is going to be when we discuss this. But I just want to encourage everyone to please go to Amazon, get some of these books here that are available. this podcast, I do it every week, trying to equip you with the best material available out there. And Dr. Bach, you have a podcast of sorts as well that people can access too, don't you? Like a table talk thing?
Yeah, I'm executive director for cultural engagement at Dallas Theological Seminary, and we are doing a thing. We issue one podcast a week called the Table Podcast. If people want to see, and it's on a variety of topics. It isn't just apologetics. In fact, apologetics is just one sliver of about eight different topic areas that we address. We've discussed issues of sexuality in the church, domestic abuse, immigration, world religions. It literally roams all over the place, all the kinds of topics that come up in seminary where God and culture connect. It's called the Table Podcast, and you can see them at www.dts.edu/thetable. You can see all the podcasts there. We also do four chapels a semester that are question and answer structured, where we interview someone and then let students ask questions, and we've recorded those. We have about a little over a dozen of those up, I think, that we've done. We've done over 50 hours of podcast material in a year and a half. And so, and we'll be continuing to produce these. One of the things that we're highlighting is an interview with campus leaders on secular campuses across the country, asking them what gets in the way of developing spirituality on your college campus. What are the social obstacles? What are the intellectual obstacles? What advice would you give to pastors and youth leaders to better prepare their students for their time at your university? And what advice would you give to parents in the same kind of way? And these are going to be hour-long podcasts, and our hope is over the next 3 years to do 150 different campuses across the country.
Now, people, please go download these things. Put them in your car and listen to them while you're driving, for instance. I mean, hey, you might as well make use of that commute to and from work. Rather than yelling at that driver in front of you, you can actually be educating yourself. Or while you're sitting at your computer, I mean, if you're going to like play a computer game or something, listen to a podcast at the same time. Learn something. You might be surprised how effective it gets. Dr. Bach, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All right. I was kind of thinking you might have said something, but okay. Well, let's get back to the Gospel of Luke, though. Now, you've said that you think that there is, that the text in Luke 22 about the sweating drops of blood does belong there, but someone like Ehrman, again, will come and say, yeah, but Luke is presenting Jesus as kind of the perfect man, and he's presented it in a very stoic light throughout the Gospel. This anxiety would not be characteristic of Jesus in Luke.
Yeah, and I think that the whole, whether you have that phrase in the text or not, what you see in the prayer is Jesus' anxiety. And so I think what Ehrman sometimes has selective memory about what's in a text. And he tends to play differences against one another and exaggerate them. And one of the ways he tries to get away with doing that is by omitting certain things that are a part of the conversation and not bringing them to the table. So I don't need Jesus to sweat drops of blood in order to understand that when he asks, if you are willing, take this cup away from me, that he is coming into this situation asking God perhaps to think about doing this a different way, and thus having some form of anxiety about it. Granted, if you have the text versus not having it, it makes the point more strongly, but it's still there. And so when he comes to the crucifixion later on and says, well, see, here's Jesus. He's trusting God. He isn't worried about what he's going through. He isn't feeling angst or anxiety about it. So he cites Psalm 31:5, into your hands I commit my spirit, in contrast to Mark, who has Jesus' word from the cross, be my God, why have you forsaken me? You're getting a different Jesus. And my point is, this ignores two things. It ignores this Gethsemane scene, whether it has the drops of blood or not. And the second thing that it ignores is that when you look at Mark and you look at it in a synopsis where you put the column of Mark next to the column of Luke, Mark has a place where he says, and Jesus cried out a second time. In that exact slot where Jesus cries out a second time, that's where Luke has, into your hands I commit my spirit. He doesn't have it in the place in the story where Jesus is crying out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? In fact, I'm deeply suspicious that when Luke tells his version of the story, a lot of people already know the Markan version. They know the Psalm 22 version because that version of the story is not only in Mark, it's also in Matthew. And so so he is supplementing what is known about the crucifixion story by giving us the detail of what was cried out the second time, as opposed to going a different way with a different Jesus, which is how Ehrman's going to portray it.
That goes back to what we'd said earlier, in fact, about why Luke would use Mark and why Matthew used Mark, that each one of them is building on the tradition. They're thinking, in many cases, yeah, I don't need to reinvent the wheel here. I'll use Mark in some places, but in some places I'm going to add a few details.
That's exactly right. And so what I tell students is, I like to use analogies because then they get it. I say, and I'm going to use an American football analogy, the National Football League. When we do instant replay, we're grateful for the fact that we have more with one camera angle on the play when we do replay. And there's value to that because what that does is that gives you an additional angle and it enriches your understanding of what it is that you're looking at. And so my point would be God didn't give us one gospel, he gave us four. And the reason he gave us four, along with some of the differences that we have, is that it actually adds depth and perspective to our understanding of Jesus to get this story in four different ways, from four different angles, if you will, related but distinct angles that help us to fill out the picture of Jesus. It's like having a 360 look at Jesus as opposed to a one-dimensional Jesus.
I can tell you that analogy works very well because I don't even care about football and I understood it.
Well, that's why I tried to tell it carefully because I think I recognize from your accent that you may or may not be wedded to American football.
Actually, I'm here in the South in Tennessee. Everyone around me, I think, bleeds orange for UT, and I can't stand it.
That's Tennessee, not Texas.
Yep. And when my wife watches the Super Bowl, for instance, I'm reading my book, and then when a commercial comes on, I put the book down and look up and watch the commercials.
I actually have overseas students over to my house when we have Super Bowl Sunday, and I tell them you can learn a lot about American culture by watching the commercials that are a good part of Super Bowl Sunday. Although I must say that the last few years, the quality of the variety of the commercials has really dropped. I'm really disappointed. That's becoming less and less an outstanding feature of the day.
Well, getting back to Luke, though, now you mentioned that Ehrman has a selective memory. I'm thinking it's the same kind of thing that happens in his treatment of the Gospel of Mark, for instance. He says that you have a problem if you have an angry Jesus in Mark 1, to which I say, well, actually, you've got an angry Jesus clearly in Mark 3, so what's the big deal with Jesus being angry? So what it looks like you're saying is that Ehrman is giving us the sound of one hand clapping too often.
Yeah, and some of it's spin. The difference in the reading there, whether Jesus has compassion on someone or Jesus is angry, makes a difference for how you read that particular unit. It impacts how many verses do you put with a particular idea tied to Jesus. But the differences that he's talking about do not impact the whole understanding of what Christianity is about one bit. There is nothing in any of these differences that impacts the core doctrines of Christianity. And that's been said about textual criticism literally for centuries. That's something that's been agreed upon by all the people who do textual critical work and that kind of thing. So, yes, it affects how long the list of proof texts might be for a certain idea, but it doesn't impact the presence of that idea in the canon. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that.
I think an excellent resource some people can go to is to see a transcript of how Dan Wallace did in his debate with Bart Ehrman, and this can be found in the book The Reliability of the New Testament, edited by Bob Stewart.
Yes, that's part of a series of oftentimes apologetic presentations that New Orleans Baptist has hosted. There's another volume in the same series that deals with the historical Jesus discussion. That involved John Dominic Crossan, Amy Jill Levine, Steve Patterson, you know, people who've worked with and written for the Jesus Seminar, who write about the historical Jesus from a Jewish point of view, as well as myself, Craig Evans, and Ben Witherington. And so that's an interesting volume dealing with historical Jesus issues in the same kind of way as the volume you're talking about dealt with text criticism.
Yeah, one thing I always get from this book, from this podcast, is books to add to my wish list sometime. But for now, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back soon. My guest is Darrell Bark of Dallas Theological Seminary. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back. And I'd like to remind everyone that, yes, everything we do here is listener-supported. I do everything free of charge. My guests come on here for free, in fact, and they're graciously giving their time to help you, the listener, out. And I'd like you to remember, though, that while everything I do here is free of charge, everything I have to do to live is not free of charge. Everything I have to do to keep up study is not free of charge. If you appreciate what's going on here at the Deeper Waters Podcast, please be willing to make a donation to Deeper Waters. You can find my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, and on the side you'll see a heading about how to donate to us, and that donation is actually done through Ratio Christi, where I'm the head of the Issues and Answers chapter, and that means that donation is tax deductible for you. So please consider making a donation. I would really appreciate having a steady stream of donors coming in, helping keep this podcast going. And Dr. Bark, do you have any organization that you belong to that people can donate to as well to support your work?
Well, the main thing would be, it's Dallas Theological Seminary. It runs off of contributions as well to support its ministry, as well as particularly the Hendricks Center and the podcast that we do. That's an important means, and the seminary completely underwrites the production of those podcasts. We don't charge anything for them. They're on the net for free, and yet, you know, we have a staff that produces those. So the seminary has underwritten that process really for a price of a couple of $100,000 a year to make that happen.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Gospel of Luke again. Now, we've mentioned some stories that show up only in Luke, and these are sometimes some of our favorite parables, and even people who are really skeptical of many of the Gospel traditions, such as, I think, Robert Funk has said that he thinks that the Gospel, that the Good Samaritan traces back to Luke, it is part of something that Jesus originally said. So how is it when we have these cases where we only have one source in one gospel with a story, can we make a case that Jesus likely said or didn't say this?
Yes, again, this has to do with what you come to think about the reliability and credibility of the writers in relationship to their sources. When we can test the sources and show that they're reliable, then the places where they're singly attested, there are ways to argue for the credibility of what that material is. The hard part of this is that in historical Jesus discussion is based on corroboration. How can I know outside of just accepting the source that this is true? How can I corroborate that this might be the case? And cases of singularly attested events and materials are the hardest category to corroborate, because that material is all that you have. And the only way you can do it is to say, this coheres or fits with other things that can be corroborated. It's of the same stripe. It is of the same ilk. and you can try and make the case that way, or you can appeal to, in the places where I can test this writer and see that they're generally trustworthy and generally reliable, then I can give them the presumption that they're reliable here in the places where I can't corroborate it. That's the best you can do with that kind of argumentation. And ultimately, it comes down to what operates in all kinds of communication, and that is, do I trust the source or not?
Well, when we're talking about whether Luke is reliable or not, we have mentioned some about Acts, so maybe we should kind of dive into that right now. There's the old account of Sir William Ramsay, who started studying Acts and was very skeptical of it, and later on became a Christian because he found Luke to be so entirely accurate.
He was digging up the history.
What?
Yeah, he was digging up the history. He was an archaeologist who was digging up the history, and he was finding the little pieces of information. I mentioned earlier the work by Colin Hemer on Acts of the Apostles. A lot of the stuff that he alludes to was stuff that Ramsay was involved in finding and looking up, or stuff that he had run down and become aware of. And it happened so consistently that he basically said, I've gone from totally doubting this source to completely trusting it.
And I think it's even been said that Luke is the kind of historian who dots every I and crosses every T.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there have been some interesting discoveries that have shown how accurate Acts is, and that includes Luke. For instance, we used to be very skeptical about the existence of tetrarchs, I think, didn't we?
Yes. There are so many of these that, it's hard to talk about them on the radio, but there are two sets of works that are really helpful in thinking about this. The book that I've alluded to by Colin Hemer is entitled The Book of Acts and the Setting of Hellenistic History. And he literally has an entire section of this book that works through Acts in sequence and enumerates all these kinds of finds that we have, where these kinds of categories that we either thought were wrong or didn't exist or whatever, and we dug up more information that that they in fact were the case. That's one set of series, and then Bruce Winter edited a series called The Book of Acts. The Book of Acts in its first century setting. This is a series of five volumes that deal with the setting of Acts, the Greco-Roman setting of Acts, the customs and Roman custody that deal with Paul's imprisonment, the Palestinian setting of Acts, and the diaspora setting of Acts. And it's literally loaded with this kind of stuff. So, think about that. This five volumes, I'm probably looking at 2,500 pages worth of material, which is designed to say you can trust Luke for what he's writing, not just on tetrarchs, but on all kinds of things.
Yeah, I've got some of the Winter's work as well. I haven't got to read Hemer's work. I don't have it yet. I'd like to someday, but I will warn readers, if you're wanting to look for stuff, it's also pretty pricey, so you might want to try going to your seminary library or something like that, seeing if you can check them out. But we also see some skeptical writers. For instance, I know Richard Carrier says that, if you want to know that you shouldn't trust Acts, just go read Pervo.
Yeah, Pervo has it in a completely different genre. He thinks the Book of Acts is a romance. He's one of several. There's another writer who also handles Acts on this basis. But to do that, he's got to ignore all this stuff. The claim sometimes is made, well, a writer writing in the first century has got to portray it in such a way that it kind of fits the culture, and that's what's going on. But most people reading this material, even classicists, recognize that Luke is not dealing with the genre of what is called ancient romance. Don't think of romance novels when you think of this. It just has to do with hero stories. But rather we're dealing with, as I mentioned at the very beginning of our time, some type of historiography that deals with ethnography and that kind of thing in Acts. And that's history that classicists respond to and write history books around, and not this kind of romance and romantic view of the text. You know, one of the examples that's sometimes brought out by those who see a romance here is the amount of time spent on the sea voyage in Acts 27. And say, see, it's a sea voyage, and Paul is the hero, and, you know, there's a miraculous deliverance that Paul has some role in. And so that's the point of the story. It's kind of a exaltation of Paul as a hero. But actually, in the narrative of Luke Acts, there's something far more profound going on. The reason we have a long sea voyage, in my view, is that you've got this geographical order, this consecutive order that Luke has talked about. So we start off in Galilee. Well, we actually start off in Jerusalem. We go to Jesus' ministry in Galilee. He comes to Jerusalem. He's crucified. We start off in Jerusalem in Acts. Then we go to the edge of Judea, to Samaria, and then we go to the ends of the earth. Well, this long sea voyage, from the perspective of the two volumes, shows how Paul has to take a long, arduous, dangerous, divinely protected journey in order to bring the gospel to Rome, which represents the beginning of the gospel reaching the ends of the earth, because obviously Rome is the capital and hub of the Roman Empire, which extends out in all directions. And so that's why that story is there. It's not a romantic narrative detail. It's a historical narrative detail to explain what Paul's imprisonment involved and how God protected getting him to Rome, because in the narrative of Luke Acts, in the latter part of the book, the explanation is you must share the gospel with Caesar in Rome. And that shows that narrative goal being achieved.
So, once again, Carrier is going with a position that's entirely in the minority and not really granted much by scholars, is he?
Certainly by the majority of scholars. I mean, there is a wing that does this, but you've got to remember, this is another thing I often say about scholarship. If you have a skeptical worldview, you have a naturalistic worldview, then you've got to go about the business of explaining how you have all this divine activity in the Bible. And everything is going to have an alternate explanation. So it's a product, to a certain degree, of a worldview orientation that's taken before you even walk into the text. Now, in fairness, those who are naturalists will say the same thing of those who are inclined to be supernaturalists and see God's hand at work in the narrative. But the point I'm making is that this narrative makes claims about God's involvement in the world, and if you don't think God is involved in the world, then you've got to have you have alternate explanations for everything that's going on, because you've already made the decision you're not going there.
I was also thinking that so much of Acts, it's covering a long length of time, and then we get up to this narrative about the sea voyage, that it's this short length of time that's put in a longer section, and it's about an arduous journey. And I was thinking, isn't that the same kind of thing that's going on at the end of Luke, with there's so much build up, and then you get to the Passion Week, and there's so much focus on that 1 week. Couldn't Luke then be trying to put Paul in the same light as Jesus and saying, look what Paul went through, just like Jesus did?
Now, it's a very, very good point. The way in which, and this is one of the things that shows us that we've got two volumes that are linked to each other. What we've got going on here is a mirroring, where the ministry of the apostles is mirroring what happened to Jesus, and it shows how the two volumes are linked and linked intentionally.
And I remember when I was in Bible college, we had a whole class on Acts, and that some people who are very knowledgeable about how the sea works have looked at Luke's account of a sea voyage and said, this is incredibly accurate, and the way it's so accurate, it must have meant that Luke was present on board the ship.
Yeah, I mean, this has to do with how you view the details that you see, and there are always going to be two explanations. One is this is the reflection of an eyewitness, that kind of thing. The other is going to be, this is just mirroring the way the realities of the ancient world work to make it look like it's a real story. You're always going to be able to go there.
Now, since you talk about the divine activity taking place in the narratives, I'm again pointing back to Carrier, who's written about the kooks and quacks of the ancient world and said that everyone believes in this, but he'll point to the stories such as the healing in Lystra in Acts 14 and the healing of Paul when he's bitten by the snake on the island in Acts 28 and say, well, look and see how gullible these people were. But there are some writers who have said that when Luke records these stories in his own way, Luke is actually making fun of a simplistic and gullible mindset of the people that he encounters.
Well, I think that's true, and actually in some cases, you get in some kinds of events like this, you get responses in which the reaction is would be the reaction of a modern skeptic. I mean, think about the prime example of this is when the women come from the tomb to announce that the tomb is empty. What do the leaders say to the women? That's an idle tale. The way I like to tell it to have some fun is, you're suffering from post-crucifixion syndrome. You know, that's PCS. And it's been a few tough days. You need to go rest and just kind of recover a little bit of reality. The leaders are portrayed in a way that shows they're really struggling to believe what the women are telling them. Now, you'd never make up the story that way. It reflects badly on your leadership to create a story that you don't need to say it that way. The reason that's in the story is because that's in the story. And so I think we see little hints of this all along the way in terms of the way Luke handles some of the miraculous. People are open to it. You know, openness and gullibility are two different things. People are open to it, but they are not necessarily expecting it. In fact, if they were expecting it, we would expect some of these reactions of the crowds to be, oh, another day, another miracle.
And what about the idea, though, that there is mockery going on? I mean, you've said that you agree with that point, but what evidence do we have that Luke is kind of poking fun at these people that he's writing about?
Well, it's because they almost have a kind of superstitious view about what's going to happen with Paul, the Malta incident, where they expect, oh, he's been bitten by the snake, he's dead, you know, he's going to be dead, and you know, that's kind of has an automatic expectation built into it. And then when he survives, you know, they do a full 360. Now, this person must be protected by God. Actually, what I think God is doing in that particular event and what Luke is reflecting is he's playing with their worldview. And in the end, they end up responding to Paul with respect because they feel like in some way he's been vindicated that he has survived this viper bite. And that comes completely, that's a response that is built completely on an acceptance of the turnaround that these people make as Paul goes through this experience.
Okay. And when we look at that, we can see that Luke, in fact, doesn't really hold a high view of superstition, especially when we get to Acts 17, because Paul gets up and says to the Athenians, says, I noticed you are very superstitious. And Luke doesn't hold that in a high light, does he?
No, a superstition is a word that's used about by the ancients in about religions that they aren't comfortable with. That's when you use that word, and that's what you see. You know, another example of Luke not holding superstition in high regard are the exorcists who try and use Jesus' name to perform an exorcism, and they don't believe in Jesus. They actually get judged for doing so, and so. So this is not magic. In fact, another distinguishing feature from magic and superstition is seen in Acts 8. Here we have Simon Magus, supposedly the great magician of Samaria, who wants to purchase the right to do what he's unable to do as a magician. So Luke is marking out the territory of what it is the apostles are doing as something very distinct from magic and from superstition.
Since you mentioned the exorcism, Craig Evans has talked about the sons of Siva before. He says, well, there are seven there, and that's a really good number, and their father is identified, which tells you they know where they come from. They're itinerant, which means they've obviously got a reputation, people are supporting them, and their garments are described because all these emblems and such on them, they're meant to protect them from demons, and yet these seven sons, and trying to exorcise one guy, they get their tails kicked royally by this guy. It's a comparison saying, yeah, Paul can handle these kinds of things, and the demons know about him, but these other pseudo ones, they're not going to respond to them.
Exactly. It's exactly the kind of mockery that you've been talking about.
Well, we're going to take our final break then, and we'll be back wrapping things up with Daryl Bach. My name is Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back for our final session. My guest is Daryl Bach. We're talking about the work of Luke Axier. Now, since Luke is the companion of Paul, there are some people who think that Luke and Paul sometimes disagree on matters. What do you think about this?
This is like the discussion we had about Ehrman earlier in the Gospels. This goes back to a very famous article written in 1966 by a German scholar named Philip Wielauer, in which he made the point that he tried to argue that there are differences between the way Paul looks at certain things and the way Paul looks at certain things. And when I talk about this in class, to make this clear, I'll talk about Luke Paul and Paul to make the point of the comparison. And so he does stuff like the cosmological argument. He argues that the writer who writes the kinds of things about idolatry that you see in the end of Romans 1 can't be the same guy who speaks to the Athenians at Mars Hill, that the tone and the approach is completely different. That can't be the same person. And I like to make the point in talking about this that what you're seeing is Paul contextualizing his message in light of his audience. He actually subverts the presence of idolatry and the presence of polytheism at Mars Hill, but he does it indirectly in terms of how he addresses it rather than frontally. And it's showing sensitivity to his audience to do it this way. He is challenging them, but he's challenging them in a subversive kind of way, whereas when he's talking to an internal audience in the church, he is speaking very directly. He doesn't have to be careful because he's not trying to draw them into a response. He's simply describing what he sees idolatry as being and reflecting, and so in that context, he's very, very direct. This is the same person who has done ministry in the public square, who's very, very sensitive about how to address people who you're actually trying to draw to the gospel and change their worldview. And there are really two ways of going about this. One is to be very frontal and direct, which some people can and will do, and the other is to challenge them, in effect, by saying, you need to think about this in a different kind of way and think about a different way of thinking about living. And Paul chooses to do the second way at Mars Hill, not the first.
I'm also thinking about how in Acts 15, for instance, the first major disagreement that usually said be there is because how many times did Paul go to Jerusalem? And this is in comparison with Galatians, that it's either Luke is right or Paul is right. What's your take on that?
Well, again, this has to do with trying to figure out particularly what events are being alluded to in Galatians 2 and in Acts 15, whether they are the same visit or whether it reflects an earlier, briefer visit that Paul alludes to in Acts 10. And most people who put these two passages together and say they can all reflect what's going on, they tend to favor the view that sees the Acts dispute as coming up before the Jerusalem Council rather than that being part of the same visit. If you make them the same visit, then you can make a little more of the differences. And I just don't think that works.
Another situation we have with the Jerusalem Council is that in the end they send out this letter and say, one of the aspects of it is, don't eat meat offered to idols. But when we get to 1 Corinthians 8 and 10, we have Paul saying, you know, go ahead, eat the meat. And then when we get to Revelation 2, we have again the Jezebel condemned because that's, she makes them eat meat that's offered to idols. So is Paul just going against everyone here or what?
Well, actually, Paul's response in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 is more complex. And so this is part of what produces, I think, some of the difference. Paul's response is, you can eat meat in the marketplace. You're not supposed to ask. You can eat meat that someone puts before you in their home. You're not supposed to ask. But you're not to eat meat in a pagan temple. You're not to go to a pagan temple and eat meat there because its origins and what's been done with it is clear. That's actually the issue that Paul is discussing in 1 Corinthians 8 and 10. You don't need to, you are free not to sort out where the meat comes from if it's in a, if I can say, a neutral context. The moment, however, someone at the meal that you have in the home says, this is meat offered to an idol, then you don't eat. So there is a whole strand of Paul's teaching that agrees with what was said in this letter. You don't eat meat offered to idols. That is, when it's clear that that's what the meat is and that's what the meat is about, then you don't eat.
In fact, some people look at the things said in the Jerusalem Council, and all of those were connected with pagan temples. So it's
this is a point that Ben Witherington has made in some detail in his handling of the passage in Acts.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people also say that Paul spends a lot of time talking about his status as an apostle. Luke only calls Paul an apostle twice, and Luke portrays Paul.
Yeah, and in one chapter alone,
yep.
In Acts 14. Mm-hmm. And interesting, and with Barnabas, who isn't normally associated with the apostles. Here we've got two things going on. One is the term apostle can be broad or narrow. So it can simply mean a commissioned one and not refer to the 12, or it can refer to the 12. What I think Luke is doing is, and he does it in a different way, Luke is showing that Paul has all the stature and authority that the apostles have, by simply showing how consistently he mirrors what the apostles were doing in the front part of Acts. In other words, I'm not going to get into the controversy of whether Paul should be called an apostle or not. I'm simply going to show that he does the stuff that apostles are doing. And that's how he deals with the category. And then he does it rarely because for Luke, as he presents the ministry of the church, he's showing that people beyond the apostles are also ministering effectively, whether you think about Stephen or Philip or Priscilla and Aquila. They also are ministering in an effective kind of way. So he's less concerned with the exclusive role that apostles have in Acts, as he is showing the impact of the Spirit across all kinds of people who are ministering effectively. Because ultimately, Luke is concerned about the mission of taking the gospel out into all the world, and that involves the entirety of the community, not just the apostles.
And what would we say about some of the differences in theology, supposedly, such as that in the epistles, Paul says that circumcision doesn't count for anything, but yet, lo and behold, here's Timothy, and Paul decides to circumcise him. And Paul also talks about how the law is no longer in effect, but when he meets James, he agrees to go to the temple and fulfill the requirements of the law. So what are we to make of those?
Well, Paul says that in 1 Corinthians, in the same section where he's making those non-distinctions, if I can say it that way, he also says he does everything for the sake of the gospel. And I've already said that Paul is sensitive about the context that he operates in. So he goes to the temple in Jerusalem because that's a context which is literally surrounded by people who are sensitive at a Jewish level. He wants to communicate a level of respect for the things associated with Judaism out of which Christianity has emerged. And so he chooses to do that. But the moment someone says, you must do this, or this is a part of what's required in order to have a membership in the church or required for salvation, where that is the shadow that overhangs what's going on, then he'll have nothing to do with it, and he will mark out his space. And so the same Paul who draws these lines will say in the end of Romans, you know, don't fight over food, different kinds of diet. You know, there are different kinds of believers. Do what's right in your own conscience and make sure that what you do is done out of faith. That's the same Paul who is on the one hand making distinctions, on the other hand is being sensitive. So what you see is a flexible Paul who's making judgments along the way, as opposed to, if I can say it this way, a prescriptive Paul who says every situation is the same.
You know, something we should also say about Paul that we get from Acts as well, since this is the only place where we see him speaking rather than writing, and this is especially shown in Acts 17, is that Paul is a very scholarly sort of individual. He knows the pagan writings just as well as he knows probably his own Torah.
It's interesting. In fact, I think it's fascinating that when Paul is at Mars Hill, he does, although he talks about what's scriptural in content, he never cites a scriptural verse like he does in all the other places where he speaks. But instead, when he goes to cite someone, he cites a pagan poet. He tries to connect with his audience at the level at which he can draw them into the conversations by what he says. And one of the ways that he draws them into the conversation by what he says is by showing an awareness that some of the ideas that he's expressing are also held by some of the people in the cultural square where his audience functions. And he has sensitivities in that regard, and he shows it by the way he addresses them.
Now, there are some people, and I know D.A. Carson has responded to this argument, who say, well, that Paul didn't have too much success at his appearance on Mars here, and so he abandoned that kind of approach from that point on. That's what he's writing about in his letter to the Corinthians.
Yeah, I disagree with Carson on this. I think that what you're seeing is a very fundamental approach of Paul that you see also reflected in the kinds of remarks that he makes in 1 Corinthians 7 and other places like that. So I don't take this idea that it was a failure. In fact, what you get at the end of Acts 15 is that you do have some people coming to the Lord and you have a request for him to say more about these kinds of things. So I don't think Paul was in the business of saying, two conversions isn't enough, we'll have to do better next time. He's grateful for anyone who comes to the Lord by the ways in which he addresses people.
Actually, Carson, in fact, does argue against that position. It's one of the positions that he says is an exegetical fallacy in his book, Exegetical Fallacies. So,
very good. Well, then we are in agreement then.
And when Paul makes his speech also before Festus or anyone else, he's using classical Greco-Roman rhetoric, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's speaking very much with an awareness and a sensitivity to the culture that he is addressing. He shows himself as a fully equipped and prepared believer who's doing what 1 Peter 3 calls on believers to do, and that is to be prepared to give a defense for the faith that we have that Jesus is Lord, but to do so with gentleness and fear. And so a part of the way he does this is by being able to relate in significant and meaningful ways to his audience and appreciating where they're coming from and thinking about where they're coming from as his listeners, as at the same time he challenges them with things that would be challenging to their way of thinking, presents the gospel to them.
I've also heard that when he speaks to Agrippa, you know, and he says that these things were not done in a corner, but that's a way that the ancient writers recognize that he's saying this is public knowledge. This is nothing secretive. Christians won't do anything behind closed doors. These are facts. You can all go out and look and see for yourselves.
Exactly right. The text is consistently doing this in lots of places. You know, Acts isn't the only place that does this. You've got the same thing going on in 1 Corinthians 15 when Paul is talking about the resurrection. You know, he makes this list. He even makes the note that some are alive and still with us to this day, making the point that the possibility of having oral live testimony, which is important in an orally oriented culture, still exists. You can check it out.
You know, this is very important because so many people think that the Bible is opposed to evidence for believing that Jesus rose from the dead, when, in fact, if there wasn't any interest in evidence, we wouldn't even have a New Testament, most likely.
Well, I think that's true. I think that there is a strand within, among some believers, that basically says, you know, faith is faith, and evidence gets in the way of faith. You know, I believe in order to understand. And I actually think that God works with both faith and trust towards him, and he also leaves evidence in the sand for us to draw him to himself. You know, God consistently reaches out to us in ways that might seem illogical. I mean, the incarnation is the ultimate example of this. Imagine God choosing to incarnate himself and walk among us as a holy being, condescending to that level. It isn't because he has to do it. It's because he goes out of his way to do it. And I think evidences work in a similar kind of way, where there are footprints in the sand that we can point to. Not that we should have to go there, but sometimes we have to go there, particularly for people for whom they're not interested in opening up the Bible or taking the Bible seriously. They've made a judgment that the Bible doesn't count for much of anything. So to simply say the Bible says it to them doesn't do any good. You've got to give them a reason for thinking about opening up the Bible, and evidence is the way to do it. I often say to people that we've shifted in our culture from the Bible being the answer to the Bible being the question. And when the Bible becomes the question, people don't care about what's in the Bible. You've got to give them a reason to open it up. And evidences is a way to get there.
Okay, we've got a little over 4 minutes left, so we need to start wrapping things up. As in all of cases, we've only been able to touch the surface topic. If people want to find out more about you and your writings and work, where can they go?
Well, I would say the best and easiest thing to do probably is to just check an entry on Amazon.com or something like that. Almost all my books are available on Amazon.com. A lot of them are available on Kindle as well as in hardback, and that'll give you the list of things that I write. There's also a full list that's provided in the Dallas Theological Seminary catalog under faculty writings. That list is kept pretty up to date. Those are probably the two easiest, most straightforward places to go.
And since we got a little over 3 minutes left, what's the final message you would like to leave with my audience?
Well, I think the main thing is that in the midst of all the things that are said to try and undercut the trustworthiness and credibility of the Scripture, and the portrait of the theological message of the gospel that you see in Luke Acts, there's every reason in the world to trust it, and I hope that believers would care enough to get themselves to be sufficiently equipped to know how to begin to answer some of these questions. You know, I've talked about Truth Matters as a book that's an example, but let me mention another one. There's a series of volumes that Lifeway is in the process of producing called The Apologetics Commentary of the New Testament. Eventually we'll cover the whole Bible. And they go in serial order from Matthew through Acts. Volume 1 is out right now. And it deals with many of the skeptical positions that are taken about individual passages. And you have writers who spent their life in these books writing their responses to these things that are said about specific passages. When that's all done, that's going to be a terrific resource for the detailed kind of questions that sometimes come up about specific passages or specific books.
I just looked on Amazon and saw one out here, The Gospel in Acts, with Michael Wilkins, Craig A. Evans, Andreas J. Kostenberger, and yourself. Is that what you're talking
about?
That's
right. That's the one
I'm talking about.
Oh, my gosh.
My book list is going to grow so much of this comes out. Dr. Bach, I do thank you for coming on the show today, and I hope that you've enjoyed yourself, Matt. We'll see you again sometime, especially to talk about Truth Matters.
Well, I have enjoyed myself immensely. This has been great. You do a great job of asking very serious and deep questions. This is definitely deeper waters.
I hope this wasn't like a doctoral examination for you.
No, it wasn't. Not at all.
Okay. Well, I'd like to remind everyone that next week, Charles Hill is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about the early texts of the New Testament and who chose the Gospels. Canon formation right there. For now, I'm Nick Peters, thanking Dr. Bach for being my guest, and signing off until next week.
Do you like turkey sandwiches? Then you'll love the new premium carb turkey and bacon sub at Subway restaurants. It's oven roasted just right, sliced thick just the way you like it. And just when you think it can't get any better, look out. It's got crispy bacon in there too. Order one today on your choice of freshly baked bread. Then select any veggies you want to make your premium carb turkey and bacon sub uniquely yours. It's a great sub for people who really like turkey. Subway. Fresh is what we do.